Thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you also for the very kind invitation. It's a very nice opportunity for me to present my work here. Well, online rather, but still. So as the title says, this talk will be about the interactions and the dynamics of brains in string theories where supersymmetry is broken. In particular, if you want the details, you can check out this review. And the latter part of the talk will focus on this paper, which is not completely covered by the review, and some work in progress. But first, first of all, let me say, please ask any questions at any time. Feel free to interrupt me at any moment. And so let me start with some motivations first. So the models which I'm going to talk about are not any kind of supersymmetry breaking. They are specifically models where supersymmetry is broken at the string scale, right? So one question could be, why do we care, right? Why do we care about high energy supersymmetry breaking as opposed to the many existing constructions where supersymmetry is allegedly broken at low energies? Well, first of all, in those models, it's not completely clear that everything is well controlled. Not that it's completely clear in these settings either, but I think these models offer a different complementary perspective, which is in some sense more natural. What I mean is that in string theory, at least in its perturbative formulations, there really is only one dimension for parameter, which is the string tension. As such, it is somehow more natural, for any scale to be at that order, in particular for the supersymmetry breaking scale to live somewhere around there. Second of all, from a phenomenological perspective, we simply do not see low energy SUSY breaking, at least, at energies that are some 15 orders of magnitude below the Planck scale. And third, there is actually some support to this idea that supersymmetry breaking ought to occur at high energies via Swan-Pleven conjectures. So there are some recent papers that point out that there is an apparent tension between a low supersymmetry breaking scale and the consistency of the effective field theory that describes that supersymmetry breaking. It's related to the fact that as the gravitino mass and thus the supersymmetry breaking scale goes to zero, so it becomes parametrically low compared to the string scale, infinitely many new light degrees of freedom appear, rendering the original effective field theory description useless. So these are a few reasons why I think it's interesting to look at high energy string scale supersymmetry breaking. And in this context, it turns out that the dynamics of brains, even brains that would have been mutually BPS and supersymmetric, turns out to be quite rich and interesting. So now I'm going to introduce the specific models I'm going to talk about. So the models at stake are three string models in 10 dimensions that are free of tachyons despite not having supersymmetry. What I mean is space-time supersymmetry, obviously. And they comprise two types, so to speak. One is a heterotic model, and the other two are orientable models. So the heterotic model, all of these three models actually arise from certain projections from models that are better known, as you can see from this extended duality network. So the vertices of the hexagon describe the more familiar supersymmetric strings together with 11-dimensional supergravity. But there are these additional models that can be constructed via projections. So in particular, the orientifold models arise as orientifold projections of the type 2B superstring, the familiar type 2B supersymmetric string, and of the less familiar, perhaps, type 0B string, which is a non-supersymmetric tachyonic closed string model. So these two different orientable projections yield non-supersymmetric, non-tachyonic theories in tangents. And on the other hand, the heterotic model arises from a projection of the E8 cross V8 supersymmetric string, another well-known model. And again, this projection breaks supersymmetry, it is the unique projection that breaks supersymmetry while preserving the absence of tachyons in the perturbative spectrum. So these are the models at stake. And so this is what I'm going to do with them. So to begin with, I'm going to describe them in a little bit more detail. So how they are constructed and what kind of models they are. And then I'm going to describe the main problem which led this research to focus on the dynamics of brains. So the idea is that if you take the vacuum by itself in these models, it doesn't survive essentially. So if you start from 10-dimensional flat space, in the supersymmetric case, it just stays there more or less. It's a stable vacuum, it's nothing to worry about. In this case, even if you start from 10-dimensional flat space, that is not a stable vacuum of the theory. In fact, it is not even an extremum of any potential. It turns out that breaking supersymmetry introduces a new runaway effect, some sort of exponential potential that I will explain later. And in this sense, starting a perturbative expansion around flat space in these models brings about tadpoles in the amplitudes, which signal the fact that this is not a sensible vacuum around which to expand. And this means that whatever the actual vacuum of the theory is, entails a huge gravitational back reaction. So again, recall the dimensional arguments from before. The only dimensionful parameter is the string scale. So absent any other large or small tunable parameter, everything is going to be string scale curved, essentially, which is a huge problem from the point of view of string perturbation theory, because finding such a background is extremely complicated, reliably. So the strategy is to introduce this new parameter in the form of brains. Instead of just living in the pure vacuum, we're going to introduce brains in spacetime. So much like the familiar case of ordinary black holes, whereby the curvature scale at the horizon becomes smaller and smaller as the black hole becomes bigger, the more mass we put. Similarly, the more brains you put in spacetime, the more curvature is controlled near the brains, as we shall see. So this motivates this picture that I'm going to talk about, which is this macroscopic low energy effective field theory picture, where we introduce brains in spacetime and we see how the gravitational back reaction is tuned, and then we see what these brains do. So they turn out to be unstable and they repel. And then we turn to the microscopic picture in terms of essentially the string amplitudes that govern the potentials between these brains. And we shall see that the punchline of the talk is that the behavior of these brains, whether they attract, they repel, or things like this, is actually consistent in these two regimes. This is the take-home lesson that I want you to focus on. The idea is, in these non-supersymmetric theories, we have absolutely no guarantee that this would have happened, and yet we have this matching between the behaviors of the potentials in the what I'm calling the macroscopic and microscopic regime of brain interactions. So this is the game plan. This is probably a good time for questions if anybody has any. I think I can probably proceed. All right, so this is the plan. So now I'm going to move on to quickly describe the models in a little bit more detail. So let me start from the heterotic model because it is in some sense simpler. So to introduce the language and the notation, I'm going to start from the more familiar heterotic superstring. So it is convenient to characterize these models writing down the one-loop vacuum amplitudes, right? In this case, since it's a closed string, the only vacuum amplitude that appears is the torus, the one corresponding to a torus worksheet, and it takes this form. And the reason, one of the reasons why it is convenient to write this down is that it can be this integrand, which is integrated over the fundamental domain of the torus, is structured in terms of the characters of the level one affine Lie algebra of SO8. We are working in light cone quantizations, so the transverse group to a string in 10 dimensions is SO8. And these characters, the way that these characters are arranged, tell us about the perturbative spectrum of the theory. Now, the heterotic model is a little bit different because it also contains an internal sector, hence these SO16 characters. But the idea is that it tells us, first of all, that the theory is supersymmetric because the combination V8 minus V8 is zero to all mass, which means that all mass levels have boson fermion degeneracy, which implies supersymmetry. And second, it tells us the structure of the spectrum. In particular, it tells us that there is an E8 cross E8 supergamma multiplet together with the gravitational, the supergravity sector at the massless level and so on. So the punchline is the vacuum amplitude, or rather the integrand, can tell us a lot about the perturbative spectrum of the theory. The integral of this expression tells us instead about the vacuum energy. In particular, in this case, it's just zero. So this is the familiar statement that flat space is a consistent vacuum of the heterotic superstring. So there's that. At this level, things stop here. Now, things get more interesting once we introduce projections. Now, I won't get into the technicalities of how to implement such a projection. It's essentially a projection by the total fermion number, essentially. So it's minus one to the F is the operator which we are using to project the spectrum. But the constraints of the consistency constraints of these amplitudes, in particular modular invariants, are such that the projection is a little bit more involved than just projecting the spectrum as you would do in field theory. And the end result is a model that looks quite complicated. So the structure of characters looks complicated. But if we are interested just at the massless level, or the lowest line states, first of all, the tachyon would have been in this sector. But it's actually not there because level matching of the closed string spectrum projects it out of the physical spectrum. And not only that, but this sector contributes no massless states either. The remaining sectors do contribute massless states. And as you can see, there is a mismatch in the representations of the gauge group, which is now reduced to SO16 cross SO16. So automatically, you can already see that supersymmetry is broken because the representations are mismatched. But still, we do have a gravitational sector, we have the Young-Mills sector, and we have some spinners in some representations. So the theory is still interesting. But, and here's the kicker of the discussion, the full vacuum energy is of the order of the string scale. Again, there is nothing else it could have been. It has to be a number of order one because there is no parameter to tune. And if it's not zero, even if it were zero, the two loop one would have probably been non-zero because there's no supersymmetric protection. But already at one loop in this model, the cosmological constant or the string frame cosmological constant is non-zero and of the order of the string scale. which causes huge problems from the point of view of the gravitational back reaction, because this means that we're starting from a point that makes no sense. So we need to fix this somehow. So this is for the hadronic model. And moving on to the orientable models, the story is a little bit different. So what happens is that alongside the torus amplitude, when performing the orientable projection, one has to introduce additional amplitudes because there are additional Riemann surfaces that can be swept out by the strings, including the open strings, right? Because the orientable introduces open strings. So we have the Klein bottle due to the fact that now the strings are not oriented. And we have the annulus and the Mobius strip due to the propagation of open strings. So, you know, the constructions of these amplitudes again follow by consistency conditions, but the bottom line is that the only real difference at this level between the more familiar orientable projection that gives you the supersymmetric type one and the orientable projections, the projection that we are using here, is really just a sign in the Mobius strip amplitude. And the physics behind this sign is essentially telling us that we are changing the Ramond-Ramond charges of the orientable plane and the d-brains that we're putting in space-time when performing this projection. So what happens is that in the supersymmetric projection, the charges of the orientable plane and the d9 brains that you put in space-time after the projection cancel out, and also the tensions cancel out. So you're left with just a zero vacuum energy in the end. In this other case, the projection is still consistent because the charges still cancel, but the tensions do not cancel, they add up, which actually implies, again, a huge back reaction due to gravity. So a similar story happens in the case of the zero B model. The orientable projection gives the so-called zero prime B theory. This time, the orientable projection is such that the orientable plane has no tension, so it cannot possibly cancel the tension of the d9 brains that you have to put in to cancel the total charge. So at the end of the day, again, one finds a non-vanishing tension that fills the whole space-time due to these combination of O9 and D9 brains. So I want to focus, before moving on, onto a particular point, which is an important difference between these two models. So the latter zero prime B model was already non-supersymmetric to begin with, right? So no problem there. In the case of the type 2B model, this projection is not only breaking supersymmetry, but it is breaking it in such a way that the breaking is in some sense spontaneous, because this model only breaks supersymmetry in the open string sector, whereas the closed string spectrum remains supersymmetric. And the supersymmetry, the broken spectrum, the open string spectrum, which hosts the supersymmetry breaking, contains a Goldstino. It's a gauge singlet fermion. And the low energy couplings of this Goldstino with the gravitational sector were worked out long ago. And it was found that indeed this fermion behaves as a Goldstone fermion. It has the correct couplings to describe a non-linear realization of supersymmetry, which is characteristic of a spontaneous breaking. So this is a very peculiar phenomenon, which has been termed brain supersymmetry breaking, and it's important to mention it. But for our purposes, these two models behave in a similar way, in the sense that they both have this residual tension due to this O9 D9 combination. And this tension couples to everything, essentially. It couples to the dilaton and to gravity, right? At the low energy level, in the effective field theory, it can be described by a potential that looks like this. It's an exponential potential. And in the heterotic model, the non-vanishing vacuum energy also couples to gravity and to the dilaton, obviously, which means that it gives, again, a very similar looking exponential potential. So bottom line, in all of these models, the effective theory of low energies contains an exponential potential for the dilaton. This is a clear indication that the point where we started from flat space was not a stable vacuum at all, and which means that we need to take into account this, this gravitational background. So any questions about this before we move on to the low energy description? Okay. So how do we deal with these back reaction? Now, I already spoiled the answer to the question in the title of the talk. The answer is we put brains in space time and we see what they do. But it should be mentioned that people have tried many different approaches. And the bottom line is that regardless of what one does, regardless of the specific models that have been constructed, this particular runaway effect is essentially always there. And as long as it's there, the runaway is going to destroy any flat space background one starts from. And so really we need to do something drastic. We need to introduce a new parameter in the game, and which turns out to be essentially the number of brains that you put in space. So again, going back to the game plan, the first perspective I'm going to look at brains from is the low energy macroscopic perspective, where brains arise as solitons essentially, which back react gravitationally and change the geometry of spacetime. And then I'll move on to the microscopic description of how these brains interact amongst themselves. So the low energy description, as I anticipated, contains the usual garden variety low energy gravitational theory arising from string theory, but it also contains this particular potential which makes all of this happen. And it also contains a three-form field strength which couples to the charged brains in the spectrum in a particular fashion. So this alpha here is just a constant. It's a number that depends on the specific model, just as this gamma is a number that depends on the model. And so the strategy is to introduce brains, and in particular charged brains, which turn on the respective fluxes, and see what these fluxes do to the geometry. So this is the picture I'm going to try to explain, essentially. The idea is we put lots of brains in spacetime and we see what they do. And in particular, the bottom line is that as long as they are charged, they curve spacetime around them in such a way that this region is well controlled. The curvatures are small, the string coupling is small, and in this region, we can look at the interactions between these brains, for instance, by putting additional probe brains in the picture, much like was done by Polchinski long ago. And this is one way to describe the interaction between these brains. And I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but the first step is to look at the gravitational back reaction of these brains, right? So the strategy is very simple. We write down the most general ansatz for the background, namely the space-time geometry, the dilaton, and the fluxes that respect the suitable isometries of a stack of parallel brains. And when the dust settles, the only dependence is on three unknown functions of a single coordinate, which is the transverse distance from the brains. And there is this number of brains, which is essentially the, you know, the electric flux at infinity. So this is the most general answer, but plugging it inside the equations of motion leads to a non-integrable mess. And the reason is, again, this exponential potential here. So as soon as you set this supersymmetric breaking potential to zero, you recover the supersymmetric, you know, the supergravity description. And indeed, the equations are completely integrable, and one recovers the original results of, you know, so Horowitz, Strominger, Stelle, and others for black brain geometries. In the presence of this potential, everything is more complicated, but we did manage to analyze this geometry in the near horizon regime and in the far away asymptotic regime. So starting from the near horizon regime, what happens is that when the brains are charged, they develop an ADS throat, an ADS times S, Freund-Urbain compactification kind of throat, the typical throat developed by extremal black objects, like the extremal Reisner-Nostrum black hole with its ADS 2 times S2 geometry, for instance. And the curvature radii of these ADS times S factors are parametrically large, which means that the curvatures are parametrically small when you put lots of brains when generating this near horizon geometry, which is what we wanted. Not only that, but the string coupling, which is e to the phi, is also fixed by the number of brains, and it is small for large n. So this is very nice. Not only that, but we found that this solution is not just sitting in isolation, it is indeed the near horizon limit of a bigger, fuller geometry, because there are radial perturbations that are attracted to the throat, essentially. So there is a very similar mechanism to any kind of extremal black object. The idea is, starting from infinity, you have some ADM charges, you know, charge, tension, mass, something like that. And in general, starting from infinity and flowing toward the horizon, there will be a finite distance horizon in general. Only when tuning these charges, for instance, to satisfy a BPS kind of bound, then the various fields are attracted toward this near horizon throat. Right? And there has to be room for this attractor to occur. And indeed, there is room, because there are modes that are exactly the same number of modes that are that have to be fixed, as there are free parameters in the far away asymptotic regimes. So there is this matching going on, even though the middle part of the geometry cannot be worked out explicitly. We know that in principle we should be able to flow and construct the full geometry with this near horizon. So in this respect, these brains behave essentially just as in the supersymmetric case, more or less. They behave very differently. Well, let me first mention an exception to this. So I just said that usually extremal black objects develop an extremal ADS times S throat. Now, this is not always the case. In particular, you know, DP brains in type 2B strings, type 2 strings with a P different from 3 do not develop an exact ADS throat. Rather, only D3 brains develop an ADS 5 times 5 throat, the famous one. However, in this case, all DP brains develop, all the brains that we have studied, in particular, they are one-dimensional and five-dimensional, develop this throat, but the D3 brains that are present in the type 0B string do not, actually. What they do is they develop a near horizon quasi ADS 5 times S5 geometry, which is deformed by a little, a local deformation that is suppressed by 1 over n effects. So you could say, okay, sending n to infinity, I recover my EDS times S, everything is fine. except this, this only works locally, because this radial coordinate can be taken to zero when going to the near horizon. And you know, the limits do not commute. So this limit, this large n limit is not uniform. So it is more sensible to talk about a quasi Hedius Stamsas threat. So barring this exception, the other charged brains in these theories, develop these kinds of Hedius Stamsas threats. So the near horizon region is somehow under control, sensible, and in some sense expected. What happens in the faraway region, however, is completely new, completely different from the supersymmetric cases, and appears to be a deep feature of these supersymmetric breaking models. So here are the concrete equations that we wrote down. Essentially, we performed an asymptotic analysis of the equations to see which terms dominate, because again, the full equations are completely useless. But the physics is the following. So as you go away from the brains, the idea is that the brains matter less and less when determining the solution, right? When far away. And indeed, in the supersymmetric cases, what happens is that space-time just becomes flat. That's it. However, remember that there is no flat space solution to the equations of motion. So the only way out is either that space-time goes flat asymptotically as this potential goes to zero, or something else happens. So it turns out that this nice alternative does not occur. So space-time never becomes asymptotically flat far away from the brains. So the only solution is that there is no asymptotic infinity. Because if there were, it would have a Minkowski isometry group. It would have to be Minkowski, but it cannot be. So there cannot be an asymptotic faraway regime. And indeed, there is a finite distance singularity, which is universal, independent of the specific brains that you put in. And in particular, this is a pictorial representation of what's going on. So we start from this near horizon Hedius threat, which is nice and controlled. Then as you flow away from, as you go farther and farther away from the brains, space-time starts to try to expand in some sense, but then boom, it closes off at a finite distance. Of course, the regime where curvatures and couplings become strong is completely uncontrolled. So a more sensible statement is, at finite distance from the brains, something stringy happens. That's really all we can say. But still, this behavior is extremely peculiar, exotic in some sense, compared to the one that arises in supersymmetric settings. And in some sense, we had to introduce brains to see this, because if you don't introduce brains, there is nothing to see. So the idea is that the less brains you put, the more this finitely extended pocket is smaller. So ideally, when you take out all of the brains, you know, you're in a very stringy regime, but perhaps there is no sense in which smooth macroscopic space-time exists. Usually when this thing, when these things happen, one has to pass to an S-dual frame in order to describe things in a dual perturbative description. And there is a hint that this is what happens in this case. So I'll get there in the end. But are there any questions about this this framework now? Very good. So I hope this picture is clear enough. And so what now? Well, first of all, let me just double quickly on a specific case. Now, I told you that charged brains developed this Hedius threat, which is true, which means that uncharged brains usually are not well controlled at all. There is no, you know, way to figure out how the solution behaves. There is an exception to this, which are the eight brains. So the brains of highest dimension you can have before they fill out the whole spacetime. And in this case, it turns out that we recover the solution that was found long ago by Dasan Murad, which is encouraging. And this solution, it can be actually written down exactly at the level of, you know, these low energy field equations. And it does feature these finite distance singularities now at both ends, because there is no throat. So again, even though we can write this down exactly, we cannot really trust it at the edge. But now we have an explicit expression for the middle region. And as long as you tune this integration constant suitably, you can make this middle region arbitrarily big. It is going to be finite, but it can be arbitrarily big. And in the middle, things are still well controlled. So this is a little exception to this rule that you have to use charged brains. So now, having talked about what brains do statically, let's actually move on to the dynamics finally. So as you may expect, these configurations, since they are not supersymmetric, they are probably going to decay. So first of all, there are some perturbative instabilities I didn't talk about, because they're more technical and less physically interesting, in my opinion. But in addition to those, there are non-perturbative instabilities of these brains that occur because these brains repel. So this is important because in the supersymmetric case, extremal brains do not attract nor repel. So essentially, the gravitational attraction is perfectly balanced by the electric repulsion. Now, these brains, microscopically, are still extremal because the bare charge is equal to the bare tension in suitable units. And this can be shown with perturbative amplitude calculations, much as Polshinsky did back in the day. So why do these brains still repel? Well, it's because they are not isolated. They interact through the supersymmetry breaking ingredients. So in the Arentifold models, we have the O9 plus D9 combination, which mediates this interaction. And in the heterotic case, there's the vacuum energy, which gravitates and mediates this interaction. So to see this particular repulsion, or in some cases, when the brains are not charged, attraction, to see these forces, there are two ways, right? One is this calculation here in the low energy effective field theory, and then I'll show you the microscopic string amplitude calculations. So within this first framework, one way to see that brains repel is to see is to check that the near horizon throat develops brain nucleation. So the charged brains, the brains of the exact same dimensions and charge, nucleate and then they expand as bubbles, right? And this means that the number of brains that composes the flux in these near horizon throats goes down slowly, eventually, right? And so we checked this by computing, the suitable decay rate using brain instantons in this paper here. And we indeed we found a non-vanishing decay rate, which is given by this ugly expression I don't want you to focus on. What I do want you to focus on is this parameter that appears in this decay rate. So recall the decay rate is e to the minus s semi-classically, barring a one loop determinant. The point is that in order for this calculation of decay rate to be consistent, it has to be semi-classical. So the action has to be large. The Euclidean action has to be large. And this parameter that appears in this expression is essentially the charge to tension ratio of the brains that nucleate. And we know that this ratio cannot depend on how many brains you put, because this is another brain that you put that separates from the rest, right? And when studying this consistency requirement, we find that the tension of these brains needs to scale with the string coupling in a specific way in order to cancel the fact that GS depends on N, right? And at the end of the day, we find that the scaling of the tension of these brains with the string coupling is precisely the one that we find in the known examples. So recall the string frame tension of D brains is 1 over GS. Of NS5 brains, which are the ones that appear in the heterotic model here, is 1 over GS squared, right? We recover these scalings from this semi-classical calculation, which is a strong hint that these brains are indeed those, that they are the fundamental brains that appear in the string spectrum. And not only that, but we also, the formula that we find covers all exotic brains that have been studied by, you know, Pradisi, Riccioni, and Berkshoff and others. So this is a strong indication that these brains are microscopic in some sense. They come from the microscopic brains of the field. And it is also an indication that these brains repel, right? And in order to see this, after brains nucleate, we have to check that that they actually expand away from the brains that generate the throat, right? And this is our first example of an interaction potential between these brains. So again, we started from a bunch of brains that generated this ABS throat. Now, brains nucleate away from the stack, they tunnel, right? And so you have a situation where some brains are a certain distance from the original stack that generated the throat. So we are in this situation described by this picture. And now, in order for things to be consistent, these brains have to repel, to be repelled, right? To go away. And indeed, calculating this the potential, the probe potential felt by these brains, we find that a similar expression that appears in the decay rate governs the potential. And you see this constant V naught appears in both cases, and it's crucial in both cases, because while this bare charge to tension ratio is 1 in our specific models, this V naught, which is just a constant that comes about from the calculations, is strictly bigger than 1, always. Which means that not only this beta parameter is bigger than 1, strictly, which makes the decay rate non-zero, but it's also such that the gravitational attraction does not balance the electric repulsion anymore. And indeed, the unbalance is precisely in the correct direction in such a way that the repulsion wins over the attraction. It could have been the other way around, but it didn't turn out to be the case. What turns out to be the case is that this weak gravity conjecture is satisfied in this case, because this particular parameter appears. And we can think of this as a renormalization of the charge to tension ratio, right? You can just say intuitively, the supersymmetric breaking ingredients in the theory renormalize this extremality ratio in the correct direction in such a way that it becomes bigger than 1. Now, this is the story for D1 brains, probing D1 brains. And in this particular case, this is the potential that we find. For NS5 brains, you have exactly the same expression, except that 2 is replaced by 6 because of the world volume dimensions of the NS5 brains. The calculation is slightly different for D3 brains, because recall, the throat geometry is a little bit different. But when the dust settles, we find a potential that is still repulsive in the sense that it involves tunneling away. So there's a bump, and then it goes down. So in both cases, eventually the brains rebel. So this is for charged brains. Now, I told you in the beginning that alongside this macroscopic low energy calculation in this probe regime, we can also cross-check the results with a microscopic string amplitude calculation. Now, we can indeed do this, but the only case in which this is much harder is for the brain when both brains are they share a charge. So when both brains share a charge, the leading order contribution to the string amplitude that governs the potential is zero, which means that one has to go to the to the next loop order, which makes things extremely complicated because the Riemann surfaces involved are very complicated. So we couldn't manage this particular calculation, but what we did manage is essentially all the other cases. So all the cases that we can check in both the probe regime and the string amplitude regime are the cases in which the brains do not share a charge. So they can be charged, but they cannot be charged in the same way, under the same flux, the same field, right? Or they can just be uncharged completely. So you can see here, essentially, you have the whole battery of tests that we perform. So computing the probe potentials in various cases where we can actually do the computations from the the probe side, and the string amplitude result for the potential at large distances, because this is the regime where we can actually do the comparison. And in all cases, so we find results that have, they seem to have different forms because we're using different coordinates depending on the geometries at hand. But we can still check whether at large distances the brains are repelled or attracted. So in particular, this plot is this particular family of cases, which are almost all of the cases. And you can cross-check this with this string amplitude here for P and 8, right? And if you do this, you see that the large distance regime gives you the same qualitative behavior. So both in the probe regime, where the number of brains is large and the back reaction is strong, and in the string amplitude regime, where the number of brains is small and the back reaction is small, the behavior is qualitatively the same. So either they attract in both cases, or they repel in both cases. And this is one of the punchlines of the talk. And I find this quite striking because there was no guarantee that this would have been the case, right? In principle, anything can go wrong without supersymmetry. So I think this is a non-trivial check that the dynamics of brains is at least consistent with itself without supersymmetry. That's the idea. So are there any questions about this? Okay, very good. So now I'm going to move to the last part of the talk. So now that we have studied almost all of the cases, right, where we can compare the interactions between brains, there is one last case that I told you we couldn't really manage beyond the probe regime, which is when the brains have the same charge, right? In particular, the case of D1 brains and D1 brains, which have the same charge, is not really manageable from a string amplitude perspective, but it is manageable from a holographic perspective. Because I remind you, these brains generate an ADS3 geometry in the near horizon limit, which somehow suggests that there should be a holographic description in terms of the infrared regime of the world volume gauge theory that lives on these brains. So a two-dimensional CFT in this case. Now the world volume gauge theory that lives on these brains is quite messy, again, because of the absence of supersymmetry. In the ultraviolet, it's fine because it's asymptotically free. But really the holographic description ought to be in the infrared. Now, at least in the ultraviolet regime, we managed to compute the, you know, the world volume version of the interaction potential between the brains, because in this frame, in this description, the brain separation becomes a field, well, essentially a combination of these scalar fields that parameterize the positions of the brains. And when giving a you know, background value for this field and evaluating the one-loop effective potential around this configuration, indeed we find a potential that you know, is repulsive in the same sense as the one for D3 brains. So this is, again, somehow a non-trivial check that this works, because you know, a one-loop calculation involves traces over the, you know, the representations of the various fields, and somehow they match in such a way to give, as to give the correct sign. So this is for the ultraviolet regime of this gauge theory, but again, the correct proper description to match with the ADS3 near horizon throat would be the infrared of this gauge theory. Now, the infrared of this gauge theory is, in general, completely, unreachable. So it is a strongly coupled two-dimensional theory, right? And holographically, we can expect that it should flow to a CFT as such. And not even the large N limit helps, because, the Toft coupling is still large. Essentially, in this limit, you cannot because the Young-Mills coupling and n are not fixed in the infrared. At least that's what the bulk description tells us. So what can we do? Well, so this is the picture. So the idea is that this dual description involves RG flows in these infrared regimes of the world volume gauge theories, right? In the bulk description, you have that the brains repel. And eventually, we expect there to be just a single brain, even though the bulk description is useless in this regime. The world volume description of the gauge theories ought to flow to these CFTs, but we do expect deformations from these CFTs that arise because the brains separate and repel. And indeed, you know, this has been done long ago in a similar context. Integrating out this brain separation mode leads to deformations that trigger RG flows. In the case of D3 brains, you know, in the supersymmetric case, this is just a Higgsing because you can literally just separate the brains and then zoom out on the remaining brains. In this case, the brains are repelling themselves dynamically. So this is a process that keeps going on until you hit the final point, the final state. Now, why am I telling you this? Well, it's because what I told you about so far was the large N regime where the bulk description is reliable. But, and I also told you that the intermediate regime is completely, you know, hopeless, at least so far, from both sides. So what remains to be checked is the last state of this RG flow, last endpoint, which is the theory, the infrared of the gauge theory of the on the world volume of a single D1 brain. This is the simplest and only case in which we can actually do something. Right? And again, this is the case where the bulk description is stringy, right? And so somehow it should hint to an S-dual description of the physics. And indeed, this is what seems to happen. So this is essentially a more precise version of what I just said. The reason why the large N regime is not treatable in the holographic description is that, again, the Young-Mills coupling using the bulk description is actually fixed in terms of N. So perhaps there is a way to approach this using large charge methods, but you know, this is still a work in progress. But when n equals one, so when just a single brain remains, the neat thing that happens is that the scalars decouple. So this is to be expected because geometrically they should describe the positions of the brains in space. So for a single brain, the theory should become, you know, in the supersymmetric case at least, it becomes abelian, So it should work, like a geometric description should work. In this case, the theory is still non-abelian, but the scale is decoupled, so everything is fine. And we can actually treat the infrared of this theory with methods that are actually quite close to methods that were, you know, expanded upon recently by some members of the group here. And so what happens is that we can actually pretty explicitly integrate out the brain separation mode and find a deformation that triggers this RG flow that flows to this final CFT. And this final CFT can be described pretty explicitly. So what happens is that the world volume description becomes a nonlinear sigma model. And the correct the deformation to the metric due to the brain separation, you know, takes a form that looks like this. It essentially arises from a heat kernel calculation of you know, the path integral around this brain deformation, brain separation node. And this particular geometry, this target space geometry of the nonlinear sigma model, flows to a free CFT. So the geometric sector of this gauge theory flows to a free theory. And what about the rest? Well, so I told you the scalars decouple. So they actually some fermions decouple as well. They describe a free CFT. And the remaining degrees of freedom, because this is a two-dimensional gauge theory, they rearrange in a way that allows for non-abelian bosonization. And you can describe this in terms of a Vestrominovitten Coset model. So this is the punchline. In the particular case of the type 2B orientifold, which is the more interesting case, we have a free CFT that describes the scalars and the fermions. And this theory actually develops supersymmetry in this infrared regime. So we have a minimal superconformal field theory in two dimensions, which is free. And it is a candidate to describe this dual S-dual regime. And then the remaining sector, which is decoupled, is a Vestrominovitten Coset model, which is a bit complicated, but you know, this is the structure of the gauge groups, of the chiral sectors and the corresponding levels of the Kac-Moody algebra. But the key point I want to focus on is the reason why supersymmetry is recovered in this final state. The reason is that this is a, you know, a D1 brain in 10 dimensions has an SO8 transverse isometry group. And these scalars and fermions live in certain representations of this SO8 in the vector and spinor representations. And precisely because this is a string in 10 dimensions, a D string, triality of SO8, which is a very deep mathematical fact, relates, you know, gives an isomorphy an isomorphism between these representations, which allows for supersymmetry to, you know, for these degrees of freedom to rearrange into a Vestrominov supermatriclet. This is a very non-trivial occurrence, which actually gives a hint that this final state of this description could, you know, be useful in constructing a strong weak duality in order to describe what's going on in the bulk somehow, even if the regime is stringy. And the reason is that much like in the supersymmetric case where the type one orientifold is S dual to a heterotic string, to the SO32 heterotic string, in this case, this D1 brain, which is supposed to be the fundamental string of the dual theory, is indeed a heterotic-like theory because it's chiral. The supersymmetry is only acting on one of the two sectors. And it behaves much like a heterotic string, albeit with a somehow a non-geometric Vestrominovitten sector. And there is a little hint, and this is the final thing I'm gonna say, that this could be sensible because so on one hand, we have a free heterotic-like string, together with this decoupled non-geometric sector, right? So this hint to some formulation in which this new fundamental string lives on a disconnected worksheet, right? One in physical spacetime, so there's always one worksheet in physical spacetime, and the second that lives in this Vestominovitan non-geometric sector. So if this is correct, the low energy description in the S-dual theory, which now should make sense, should have contributions that are, you know, that arise from two spherical Riemann surfaces. The lowest order contribution should be 1 over Gs times 1 over Gs squared times 1 over Gs squared. So e to the minus 2 phi times e to the minus 2 phi, because it comes from the three-level contributions of both sectors. So it turns out that if you take the original effective field theory with the Suzy breaking exponential potential, and you do the operation that in the supersymmetric case gives you the S-duality in the effective field theory, we get exactly the right scaling. So this is, of course, at best, a very, very preliminary amusing hint, not saying anything here, but it should be said that this kind of disconnected worksheets have been discussed in the past when discussing non-perturbative effects in string theory. So just to wrap up, I guess the two punchlines I want you to take home from this are that this kind of string scale supersymmetry breaking effects have a huge effect on spacetime. Particular, it becomes in some sense broken at a finite distance with that singularity. And that putting brains in the picture can help with gain some control and insight on the physics, in particular because the interactions between these brains appear to be consistent across various regimes of calculation that are complementary, and there is no apparent protection that tells you that they should match, but they do match, at least qualitatively. And finally, this last thing I talked about, the holographic description, seems to hint at some kind of non-perturbative duality that could help describe the physics in this stringy regime. So yeah, that's it. I hope it was clear enough. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the very interesting talk. Are there more questions for Ivanu?
There appear not to be.
If there are no, let's thank Ivanu again.
Thank you very much for having me.